says the upcoming meeting of the JCPOA Joint Commission will discuss what measures to be taken before Tehran goes back to its full nuclear commitments. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia voiced support for Jordan's King Abdullah following security crackdown on officials and royal family members. All schools and non-essential stores are closed in France. This while the European country is entering its third national lockdown to tackle a surge in coronavirus cases. It's good to have you with us. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister is saying that Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with the United States, and this is while the signatories to the nuclear deal are preparing to meet in Vienna on Tuesday.
We will have no direct or indirect talks with the Americans in Vienna. We will hold negotiations with the Joint Commission of the Iran Nuclear Deal, and we'll lay out our demands and conditions for a return to our nuclear deal commitments. Our demands and conditions are that the U.S. fulfill all its obligations under the JCPOA first by removing all sanctions it imposed on Iran. Then we will verify the sanctions removal and return to our commitments.
The official made comments after briefing the Iranian Parliament's National Security Commission and the upcoming talks. Former U.S. President Donald Trump exited the nuclear deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions. A year after the U.S. move, Iran took remedial measures to reduce its commitments. Tehran says its economic benefits under the accord are key to reversal of the nuclear steps it's taken so far. Jordan's former crown prince says that he's under house arrest as the authorities have detained several ranking officials over an alleged plot against King Abdullah.
I had a visit from the chief of the general staff of the Jordanian armed forces this morning, in which he informed me that I was not allowed to go out to communicate with people or to meet with them.
In a video recording, Prince Hamza bin Hussein also said that his bodyguards and a number of friends were also detained. The prince, who's the king's half-brother, said that he was not part of any foreign conspiracy, but denounced the ruling system as corrupt. The Jordanian military, in a statement, said that the prince was told to cease actions that would hurt the kingdom's security and stability. The statement also says that Hamza was part of a broader ongoing security investigation. A top former Jordanian royal aide was among those arrested. The U.S. and a number of Arab states have voiced support for King Abdullah over the developments. Now let's see what our panelists and guests think about the issue. So joining me in this news review edition will be Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief at the International Interest in London. We also have another guest from London, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Now let's go to Sami first. What's going on in Jordan, Sami? Does it have to do with the economic situation there, rivalry among maybe royal family members or other countries' involvement?
I think it's true that Jordan has its own domestic issues. I think right now information is still coming out as to the reasons why this move has been taken by King Abdullah of Jordan to move against the former crown prince. But it's also important to understand the context within which these moves are taking place that might be relevant. The first is antagonism towards Israel. We know that Jordan prevented Netanyahu from flying over Jordanian airspace to go to the UAE in order to make a show of normalization. Jordan has been resisting the Arab normalization ties with Israel, primarily because it believes that it will bear the full brunt of any fallout that might come about as a result of normalization, the fallout between Israel and the Palestinians. Jordan has a large Palestinian population that have not necessarily been absorbed into Jordanian society, primarily because the Jordanian government believes that, of course, there is an economic burden in dealing with these Palestinians. That's not to imply that there is any malintention on the part of the Jordanian government, but an economic reality. And it's also important to highlight that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and other Gulf countries have been trying to schmooze Jordan by increasing the financial packages that have been given to Jordan in order to help with its economic situation, in order to ensure that King Abdullah becomes a bit more pliant towards the more controversial policies such as normalization, of which not Saudi Arabia and the UAE will bear the brunt of it, but rather the neighboring countries, of which Jordan is one of them. So it is in this context that there are theories that are being bandied about that because King Abdullah is dragging his heels and not playing ball, that perhaps Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Israel, and Washington, of course, would go along with it because it's the desire of Israel, would welcome a change in the king of Jordan if the former crown prince is rather amenable to it. It is in this context that this news has emerged.
Okay. Now, let's ask Said Mohsen Abbas what he thinks what's going on in Jordan, and what's your assessment of the developments there, and also tell us a bit what you think of the support lent to Jordan by the U.S.
Well, Jordan has really been in the pockets of the Zionist-Western imperialist axis since 1970, and maybe even before that, to be honest. They've never been a force for real, if you like, opposition or resistance, and they have very amicable ties with Israel treaties, indeed. So Jordan's problems are many, but I rather concur with my colleagues' tilt, I think, towards the possibility that what's going on here is a veiled threat to Jordan's King Abdullah is being presented, that they want him to conform, they want him to stay in line, they want him to do what they need him to do in the coming circumstances, whatever they've got planned in terms of the expansion of Israel, in terms of the occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, perhaps even on other fronts across the region. Jordan's been complying. The Al-Tanf base, for instance, has been a very strong center for ISIS and production of ISIS, for instance. Yet Jordan has its own internal issues as well, Salafist and movements that would call themselves Islamic exist there, and they could be a problem. There are combinations of rising internal challenges. The East Bankers, for instance, have traditionally had a problem with, of course, Palestinians who've moved in there, but they've also were, since 2013 onwards, I think they've been a little bit miffed at the way corruption and power and finances have been distributed away from their own kind of tribal regions, etc. So there are many challenges that King Abdullah has faced. The refugee overspills from the Syrian civil war, much of their own doing, because they're also backing most of the ISIS and US policy. So the key issue is US and Israel. What will they see? What do they want from Jordan? Because that's where all the strings are really pulled from. Ultimately, none of this can be happening without CIA or Mossad prior knowledge. They cover and watch everything there. They would have known about this and are very likely involved in either engineering both sides to ultimately benefit their regional interests.
Mm-hmm. So, Sami, do you think this could signal maybe an end to the rule of the Jordanian king?
I don't think so. I think in the grand context of what's taking place there in the region, Jordan still plays a vital role. We saw this tripartite meeting that took place between Iraq, Egypt, and Jordan. Jordan is sort of holding the stick from the middle, as we say in Arabic, where it's essentially doing enough to appease Saudi Arabia and the UAE and doing enough to appease other parties. So as it's seen as this sort of mediator, and so it's seen as trying to insulate itself from the problems. It's important to understand that Jordan's geographic situation means that the other powers that are involved in Syria, whether that's Iran, Russia, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, and UAE to a lesser extent these days, I think it's important to understand, as my colleague rightly noted, that the refugees tend to spill towards Jordan as opposed to Saudi Arabia, UAE, or the other various different countries. Of course, we can put Turkey as the exception here. And the problem is that when you add that to the mounting economic crisis in Jordan and the need for the king to keep a sort of balance between the tribes that help to help to ensure this current monarchy that takes place in Jordan, the reality is that King Abdullah believes he's in a very difficult financial strait. And of course, he's relied on the Gulf to bail him out on numerous occasions. He relies on that financial aid, not just from the US, but also from the Gulf. But it's it's important to highlight as well that King Abdullah is perceived by the Palestinians as a supporter of their cause. King Abdullah has not been painted with the same brush as Saudi Arabia and UAE in recent times. King Abdullah has put his foot down when it's come to normalization. He's put his foot down when it comes to facilitating normalization. He's also put his foot down with regards to the general tide or trend that is going towards acknowledging or recognizing, between quotation marks, Israel's interest. It may not necessarily be for a principled stance or principled stance or because of Palestine in and of itself. As I said before, Jordan bears the brunt of any agreement that will take place between Israel and between the Arab states. But nevertheless, it's important to stress that Jordan has often been seen as a haven for the Palestinians. And therefore, I think the reluctance of King Abdullah to play ball, the open manner in which he has objected to the tide towards normalization, the way he has come out with rhetoric that is perhaps not aligned with those who give him that financial backing on which he is dependent, will no doubt have upset Riyadh and upset Abu Dhabi and upset Netanyahu and upset Tel Aviv. So it's not far-fetched that they would gladly see King Abdullah go.
Sami,
however, there is the other side of things.
Sami,
which is
we
that
are
we should not
running out of time. Sami, if you allow me, I'll also give 1 minute to Mohsen Abbas for his reaction.
Sure. I think it's right. Look, the indicators have been there. The deputy director of security of the Israeli embassy in Amman was involved in an incident. He said that was around 2017. 2019, King Abdullah also described Jordan's relations with Israel as being at an all-time low, mostly because of the domestic policy issues in Israel. And, of course, he didn't allow the flight of Benjamin Netanyahu over the country on the way to the UAE with all this normalization. So Israel then accused Jordan of doing this deliberately as a response to a dispute over Israeli entry permits, it said, for Jordanian Crown Prince Hussein bin Abdullah's security detail for a trip to Al-Aqsa Mosque. So tensions have clearly been there. I concur with my co-guest that I think the hand of the secret services from the Zaire Western powers is pretty much all over this. They're obviously trying, I think, quite clearly, to coerce and force and threaten the king into complying and to end his kind of noises. They're trying to annex Jerusalem. Jordan is the custodian of Al-Aqsa Mosque, still nominally. And, of course, that is possibly another step to saying, well, you know, you've got to let go of Jerusalem as well. Who knows? But certainly that, for me, spells trouble for King Abdullah unless he complies with everything that the Zio-American axis tell him.
Okay, that's all the time we had. Let me thank our guests. We had Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief at the International Interest, and also Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and public commentator, both joining us from London with their comments. And that's the end of this news review. Welcome back. Let's move ahead with the rest of this news broadcast. Israeli settlers have forced their way into Jerusalem's Flashpoint Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to celebrate a Jewish holiday. The Palestinians have condemned this, calling it provocative. My correspondent has more.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qadir, occupied Ramallah.
In other news, France has entered its third national lockdown while it is tackling a surge of COVID-19 cases. All schools and non-essential stores will shut down for 4 weeks. A curfew will be in place from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. From Tuesday, people will also need a valid reason to travel more than 10 kilometers from home. The new wave of the disease threatens to overwhelm the country's hospitals. France is currently battling a peak of around 5,000 COVID patients in intensive care units. On Friday, it recorded nearly 47,000 new cases and 304 deaths. Those figures pushed the death tally to 96,000 and the case load to 4.7 million. Meanwhile, thousands of people have taken to the streets in the German city of Stuttgart to protest the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Police say the demonstration was almost peaceful, but face mask requirements and social distancing rules were mostly ignored. Authorities, however, decided to let the demonstration go ahead. Last month, officials announced the country would be placed in a strict Easter lockdown, but they withdrew the decision days later. According to the Robert Koch Institute, the number of confirmed corona cases in Germany has risen to more than 2,873,000. The tally also shows that nearly 77,000 people have died of the virus. In Bulgaria, people are heading for the polls to elect a new parliament amid predictions of low turnout on coronavirus pandemic fears. More than 6.7 million Bulgarians are eligible to cast their ballots. Prime Minister Boyko Borisov's center-right party is tipped to finish first. Opinion polls, however, suggest the party in power for almost a decade will fall short of a majority. Its popularity has been eroded by a series of scandals, with protests last summer accusing the government of protecting oligarchs. Observers say that the party may struggle to build a stable coalition in a more fractured parliament. The election is held as hospitals in the EU's poorest country are overwhelmed with COVID patients. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
You. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba vujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
When the believers saw the Confederate forces, they said, "This is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us, and Allah and His Messenger told us what was true." And it only added to their faith and their zeal in obedience. Chapter 33, verse 22. When we face a difficult circumstance, we should not become agitated, and we should not make others agitated. This is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us. They had already told us that if we move on the path of the truth, we should expect this. Likewise, did we make for every messenger an enemy, evil ones, among men and jinn, inspiring each other with flowery discourses by way of deception. Chapter 6, verse 112. We should not be surprised at these things, because they have already told us about them, and we knew it in advance. When such circumstances arise, this ayah manifests itself to us and shows us the path we should take in life. There are many other ayahs and examples in this regard as well.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
One of the issues that occupies my mind as an official in the system is the ayah addressed to Hadhrat Yunus, Jonah, God's greetings be upon him. He made a move out of desperation and exhaustion as his people did not respond to his invitation. Then Allah the Exalted said to that prophet, who had gone through a lot of trouble for a lifetime and who had worked tirelessly all his life, "And remember the Nun when he departed in wrath. He imagined that we had no power over him." Chapter 21, verse 87. He thought that God would not be strict with him, but God was indeed strict with him, as a result of which Hadhrat Yunus was disciplined like that. When I feel inactive and passive, whether I get this feeling myself or feel that other officials suffer from it, I remember this ayah. He imagined that we had no power over him. We think that such negligence and inactiveness will not receive a harsh response from Allah, the Exalted. But this is not the case, because this might happen to us and show itself in reality.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
limelight.
Stacey Blatt was in hospice care last September, listening to Rush Limbaugh's dire warnings about how badly former President Donald Trump's campaign needed money when he went online and chipped in everything that he could. $500. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shane Goldmacher, Rachel Shorey, and Kitty Bennett. The piece is titled, How Trump Steers Supporters into Unwitting Donations. Stacey Blatt was in hospice care last September, listening to Rush Limbaugh's dire warnings about how badly former President Donald Trump's campaign needed money when he went online and chipped in everything that he could. $500. It was a big sum for a 63-year-old battling cancer and living in Kansas City on less than $1,000 per month. But that single contribution, federal records show it was his first ever contribution, quickly multiplied. Another $500 was withdrawn the next day, then $500 the next week, and every week through to mid-October, without his knowledge, until Mr. Blatt's bank account had been depleted and frozen. When his utility and rent payments bounced, he called his brother Russell for help. What the Blatts soon discovered was $3,000 in withdrawal by the Donald Trump campaign in less than 30 days. They called their bank and said they thought they were victims of fraud. It felt, Russell Blatt said, like it was a scam. But what the Blatts believed was duplicity was actually an intentional scheme to boost revenues by the Trump campaign and a for-profit company that processes online donations, WinRed. Facing a cash crunch and getting badly outspent by the Democrats, the campaign had begun last September to set up recurring donations by default for online donors for every week until the election on 4th of November. Contributors had to wade through a fine print disclaimer and manually uncheck a box to opt out. As the election neared, the Trump team made that disclaimer increasingly opaque, an investigation by the New York Times showed. It introduced a second pre-checked box, known internally as a money bomb, that doubled a person's contribution. Eventually, its solicitations featured lines of text in bold and capital letters that overwhelmed the opt-out language. The tactic ensnared scores of unsuspecting Trump loyalists, retirees, military veterans, nurses, and even experienced political operatives. Soon, banks and credit card companies were inundated with fraud complaints from former President Trump's own supporters about donations they had not intended to make, sometimes for thousands of dollars. Bandits, said Victor Amelino, a 78-year-old Californian who made a $990 online donation to Donald Trump in early September via WinRed. It recurred seven more times, adding up to almost $8,000. I'm retired. I can't afford to pay all that damn money. The sheer magnitude of the money involved is staggering for politics. In the final 2.5 months of 2020, the Trump campaign, the Republican National Committee, and their shared accounts issued more than 530,000 refunds worth a staggering $64.3 million to online donors. All campaigns make refunds for various reasons, including to people who give more than the legal limit. But the sum the Trump operation refunded dwarfed that of Joe Biden's campaign and his equivalent Democratic National Committees, which made 37,000 online refunds totaling $5.6 million in that time. The recurring donations swelled Donald Trump's treasury in September and October, just as his finances were deteriorating. He was then able to use tens of millions of dollars he raised after the election, under the guise of fighting his unfounded fraud claims, to help cover the refunds he owed. In effect, the money that Donald Trump eventually had to refund amounted to an interest-free loan from unwitting supporters at the most important juncture of the 2020 presidential race. Marketers have long used ruses like pre-checked boxes to steer American consumers into unwanted purchases, like magazine subscriptions. But consumer advocates said deploying the practice on voters in the heat of a presidential campaign at such volume and with withdrawals every week had much more serious ramifications. "It's unfair, it's unethical, and it's inappropriate," said Ira Reingold, the executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. Harry Brignall, a user experience designer in London who coined the term dark patterns for manipulative digital marketing practices, said the Trump team's techniques were a classic of the deceptive design genre. "It should be in textbooks of what you shouldn't do," Harry Brignall said. Political strategists, digital operatives, and campaign finance experts said they could not recall ever seeing refunds at such a scale. Donald Trump, the Republican National Committee, and their shared accounts refunded far more money to online donors in the last election cycle than every federal Democratic candidate and committee in the country combined. Overall, the Trump operation refunded 10.7% of the money it raised on WinRed in 2020. The Joe Biden operation's refund rate on ActBlue, the parallel Democratic online donation processing platform, was just 2.2%, according to federal records. Several bank representatives who fielded fraud claims directly from consumers estimated that WinRed cases at their peak represented as much as 1 to 3% of their workload. An executive for one of the nation's larger credit card issuers confirmed that WinRed at its height accounted for a similar percentage of its formal disputes. That figure may seem small at first glance, but financial experts said it was a shockingly large percentage, considering that political donations represent a tiny fraction of the overall United States economy. In its investigation, the New York Times reviewed filings with the Federal Election Commission from the Trump and Biden campaigns and their shared accounts with political parties, as well as the donation processing sites ActBlue and WinRed, compiling a database of refunds issued by day. The New York Times also interviewed 24 Trump donors who made recurring donations, as well as campaign officials, campaign finance experts, and consumer advocates. Nearly a dozen bank and credit card officials from the nation's leading financial institutions spoke for this article under condition of anonymity to discuss internal matters. A clear pattern emerged. Donors typically said they intended to give once or twice and only later discovered on their bank statements and credit card bills that they were donating over and over again. Some, like Mr. Blatt, who died of cancer last February, sought an injunction from their banks and credit card institutions. Others pursued refunds directly from WinRed, which typically granted them to avoid more costly formal disputes. WinRed said that every donor received at least one follow-up email about pending repeat donations in advance, and that the company makes it exceptionally easy with 24-hour customer service for people to request their money back. WinRed wants donors to be happy and puts a premium on customer support, said Garrett Lansing, WinRed's president. Donors are the lifeblood of Republican campaigns. He noted that Democrats and Act Blue had also used recurring programs. Jason Miller, a spokesman for Donald Trump, downplayed the rash of fraud complaints and the $122.7 million in total refunds issued by the Trump operation. Jason Miller said internal records showed that 0.87% of its WinRed transactions had been subject to formal credit card disputes. The fact we had a dispute rate of less than 1% of total donations, despite raising more grassroots money than any campaign in history, is remarkable, Miller said. That still amounts to about 200,000 disputed transactions that, Jason Miller said, added up to $19.7 million. Our campaign was built by the hardworking men and women of America, Jason Miller said, and cherishing their investments was paramount to anything else we did. Asked if Donald Trump had been aware of his operation's use of recurring payments, the campaign did not respond. Donald Trump's hyper-aggressive fundraising practices did not stop once he lost the election in November. His campaign continued the weekly withdrawals through pre-checked boxes all the way through to 14th of December as he raised tens of millions of dollars for his new political action committee, Save America. In March, Donald Trump urged his followers to send their money to him and not to the traditional party apparatus, making plain that he intends to remain the gravitational center of Republican fundraising online. By June, the campaign and the Republican National Committee were experimenting with a second pre-check box to default donors into making an additional contribution called the Money Bomb. An early test arrived in the run-up to Donald Trump's birthday on 14th of June. The results were tantalizing. That date, a seemingly random Sunday in June, became the biggest day for online donations in the campaign's history. Ronna McDaniel, the Republican National Committee's chairwoman, crowed to Fox News about the achievement without mentioning how exactly the party had pulled it off. Republicans are thinking smarter digitally, she said, and were poised to outwork, outdo, and outmaneuver the Democrats at every turn. The two pre-checked yellow boxes would be a fixture for the rest of the campaign, and so would a much larger volume of refunds. Until then, the Biden and Trump operations had nearly identical refund rates on WinRed and Act Blue in 2020, 2.18% for Donald Trump and 2.17% for Joe Biden. But from the day that Donald Trump's birthday, 14th of June, through rest of the year, Joe Biden's refund rate remained nearly flat at 2.24%, whilst Donald Trump's refund rate soared to a massive 12.29%.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, honor and dignity of a human. Islam exists because of man. It is meant for him. Man, in turn, exists because and for Islam, to be shown how to live in complete service to his Creator and Master, and to be shown the way to self-assertion and deliverance in both worlds. Thus, the most important knowledge that Islam grants man is the knowledge about himself, his Lord, and his relationship with him, and about the life phenomena and his place as well as his role in it. Indeed, this is the greatest blessing that man enjoys in Islam. It is a demonstration of man's honor and dignified position that he occupies in the hierarchy of Islamic beliefs, values, and principles. It is due to this that Quran often articulates such testimonials as, for example, "We have indeed created man in the best of molds." This is chapter 18, verse number 4. "Verily we have honored the children of Adam." Again, see, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is honoring. This is Al-Isra, verse number 70. "Do you not see that Allah has made subject to you whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and amply bestowed upon you his favors, both apparent and unapparent?" This is chapter Luqman, verse number 20. "Read, and your Lord is most honorable, who taught to write with the pen, taught man that which he knew not." This is chapter Al-Alaq, verses 3 to 5. Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the honor and dignity of a human, and before the break, we brought to you a few verses which are very clearly telling us that Allah has dignified and honored his creation, human beings. It goes without saying that the ultimate objective of the Islamic message is to preserve a believer and his honor and dignity. This translates into preservation of his religion, life, lineage, intellect, and property. There is nothing on earth that is more inviolable than a believer, his blood, property, and honor. There is nothing that supersedes him in importance. Everything on earth exists in order to make possible and then sustain a believer's lofty position. All things and events play second fiddle to his status. Even holy messengers were sent and revelations revealed for the very purpose of preserving the dignity of human beings. Based on the divine will and letter, life systems, ordinances, and practices are concocted for this same end as well. Accordingly, cultures and civilizations are judged only on the basis of how genuinely they were human honor and dignity oriented, and how much they succeeded in making such enterprise a reality. See how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted honor to a human being. The question is, do the human beings carry and preserve this honor or not? Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understands the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The U.S. and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia, citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its eastern front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
As United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion, 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September. The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As the Yemeni
army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Madib from Saudi-backed forces. Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen, a move which considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated, because in reality we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in our classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain, or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon.